Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
In a country often divided by political, economic, racial, and religious differences, the places where those lines fall away are worth celebrating, which may be one reason we love our sports arenas. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Whether we experience them on TV or in person, great stadiums are both comfortingly familiar and dazzlingly exotic, with their gleaming scoreboards, roaring crowds, and impossibly green fields. Part of the magic for us as fans is that sports venues are by definition places where special events take place. When we enter, they are fully stocked and intensively focused on keeping us entertained, excited, and well-fed. Of course, there is always a lot more to the magic than what we see from our seats, and my guest wanted to understand the effort and expense required to keep us coming back. Rafi Kohan is a freelance writer and former deputy editor at the New York Observer. His new book is called The Arena: Inside the Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Racing, Dubiously Funded, and Possibly Haunted Monuments of American Sports. He joins us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Rafi, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
You remind us that sports venues are one of the last places we go to experience a live, collective cultural event, but it's not as collective in 2017 as it was a few decades ago.
No, it's not. That's one of the trends in sports stadiums now, is how we're sort of having these very segmented experiences when we go to live events, whether it's in a luxury club or in a kids area or a tequila bar or, you know, the standing room, whatever it is. But that is a big time trend right now in ballparks and in stadiums, is this idea of kind of creating the space for everyone. So even though we're all going there, we're walking through the same gates, well, unless you're showing up at the valet parking at, you know, AT&T Stadium, then we're still sort of having our own individual experiences within it to a certain extent. It's an interesting space in that sense.
How much do modern arenas have in common with the Greek and Roman amphitheaters that inspired them?
Quite a bit. In fact, a lot of the architects that I spoke to really talked about how, you know, the Roman Colosseum in many ways just kind of nailed it. You know, we had vomitories, they had water systems to bring, you know, hydraulic systems to bring water to every level, to bring people water and also wash away waste. There was numbered tickets, very kind of like basic things. They just nailed it. And in a lot of ways, stadiums are the same spaces that they were 2,000 years ago. Well, I spoke to Mark Williams, who is a Dallas-based architect behind AT&T Stadium. And he said that was one of the challenges, actually, when they went into working with Jerry Jones and his family to build a new stadium for the Cowboys, was that football stadiums in particular, you know, you look at Lambeau and you see this kind of perfect bowl arrangement. You know, you could easily strip away some of the outside concourses and concession stands and just put up some ancient stones, and you'd be forgiven for thinking that you're, you know, about to go watch a gladiator spectacle. But that they wanted to reimagine it. And there's, to a certain extent, there was only so much they could do. So really, part of what they did was think about it in terms of these different segmented experiences. How can they reinvent the fan experience? And also trying to, you know, think about the stadium not just as a stadium, but actually as a building. You know, he likes to take people on a tour, a specific route, which is when they enter, it's about 15 minutes before you even see the field. And he likes to go on this particular way because about 10 minutes in, you just forget that you're even in a stadium. You think you're in the Four Seasons.
You say that the experience plan for fans at AT&T Stadium was ripped from the Disney playbook, which is to say it's not just about staging events, it's to create brand loyalty by making sure that the kids have a good time.
Absolutely. I mean, I know you're based in Dallas, so it's convenient to say it, but it's true that nobody does it better than Jerry Jones and the Cowboys in terms of really commoditizing our sort of emotional investments in these facilities and in these teams. They do it in a very natural way, which is weird to say, because it is so overtly commercial and corporate in a lot of very obvious respects, but at the same time, they create the space for emotional connection. One example that I give in the book is these tours that people are allowed to take on non-game days. You pay your $25 because, you know, of course, you have to pay to get into AT&T Stadium. That's how it works. But they take you on a really elaborate tour. They show you the bowels of the stadium, and then eventually they deposit you on the field, and they allow you to spend as much time as you want there. There's no time limit. You can lie on the cowboy star in midfield. You can toss a football. Some people even, this was told to me by a Cowboys staffer, some people even sneak in an officiant and get married on the field for the cost, you know, for the cost of admission for a tour. Then, of course, you know, the Cowboys photographers take photos, and that's where your wedding photography comes from. But that's, I mean, that's creating an emotional memory. If you can spend your time tossing a football with your dad or with your kid on the field, you take that with you. Another example was they allow Boy Scout troops in to have overnights on the field. They play video games on the 60-yard Jumbotron overhead.
Wow.
And as Mark Williams put it to me, he says, I guarantee you one of those kids is going to be a sweetholder someday. And he's right.
You can't tell the story of Jerry World, a.k.a. AT&T Stadium in Arlington, without diving into the dicey politics of how it got built and where and who paid for it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's true for almost any modern stadium, is it would be an oversight not to discuss that, because these are our new signature civic buildings. These are the things we're spending our money on, we're making emotional and cultural investments in. And increasingly, we're asked to make, you know, significant public contributions when it comes to taxpayer money. In Arlington, as you know, no doubt know, you know, it went to a ballot, and there was a half-penny sales tax that was originally used to pay for the Rangers Stadium, and then that was repurposed for the Cowboys Stadium. But these things do not happen without fights. There is very often a loud, vocal opposition, because this is, in many people's minds, a form of corporate welfare. And it's pretty easy to make that case, since these are billionaire owners who often get sweetheart leases as a, you know, as part and parcel of these new stadiums coming online. And they also receive, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars to help pay for help pay for construction. And the argument on the other side is, of course, that there will be an economic benefit, you know, that you'll pay for this now, but you'll get so much more later. And, you know, we can get into the reality of that, which is, I spent a lot of time reading into the economic literature on this and talking to sports economists and just other folks who spent time studying it, like Neil DeMaus, who runs a website and wrote a book called Field of Schemes. And basically, all the evidence suggests that these things are not good economic drivers. For as much as we're told that we will make our money back tenfold after the fact with rosy economic forecasts, really the best we can hope for is that we break even and we don't end up in a situation where, in fact, the municipality is left holding the bag. It might have to dip into a general fund to, you know, help pay for operating costs or construction costs, as has happened in many cities. In one terrible example is in Cincinnati, where as a result of these rosy forecasts that didn't come to fruition, they ended up having to close hospitals as a result. And that's, you know, so it can get pretty dicey.
Well, time was, Rafi, when we had 50 years or more that a stadium would be functional. So that was a little more time to see if we could break even. How did it happen that the expiration date on modern stadiums has shortened to like 30 years, 35 years, in some cases just 20 years?
Yeah, it's a great question how it happened. I wonder. I mean, and really the thing, I think to me this is the thing that's most galling about modern stadiums, and I say that as a giant sports fan and someone who loves going to games, is the idea that they're built with this kind of planned obsolescence. You know, these are our signature civic buildings. Professor by the name of Bob Trumpor, who wrote a book called The New Cathedrals, he is a professor at Penn State University, you know, compares these buildings to old cathedrals or ornate train stations or skyscrapers, that basically these are the things we're investing in as a society. These should be our legacy. So what does that say about us when, in fact, if these, you know, the cycle is going from 50 or 60 or more years to being 20, 25, 30 years. I think that's, I mean, it's a sad statement about us. Why, as to why that is the reality is just that, you know, I think team owners, it's sort of an increasing game of leapfrog in some ways, right? That as soon as one stadium gets something new, then every other stadium wants it because it's a new revenue source, or, you know, they've invented some new luxury product. And, you know, a lot of stadiums have these state-of-the-art clauses in their leases, which basically says if you're not in the top third or half of the league, that basically you'll be given the funds to sort of take, you know, jump back into that class. But as I pointed out in the book, that's a mathematical impossibility for every team in the league to always be in the top third. Right. So we're just keep jumping over each other one after another after another, and we're always asked to help chip in, which, you know, again, is not necessarily something that is, I'm saying, should not be done at all, but I think is something that should be done in following a more honest conversation in terms of what are the benefits, economic or otherwise, because there are other types of value, things like quality of life and civic pride. But let's talk about it in terms of those things, and let's also then have more realistic leases so that we don't have to close hospitals and shut down schools and leave roadways unrepaired so that teams can make more money from luxury boxes.
So planned obsolescence is a thing, but then we have stadiums like Wrigley Field and Fenway Park, which seem to have managed to evolve over time so that they're honoring the past, but fans are still getting something of the kind of modern experience they've come to expect.
Yeah, and isn't it so special that we still have those places?
Yeah.
Because it could so easily have not been that way. As recently as the 1980s, Wrigley Field was not considered this gem of a ballpark. I mean, that's something that's happened much more recently. Talking to folks within the Cubs organization, they admit as much. Crane Kenny, who's the president of business side operations there, he refers to Wrigley as an accidental relic, and that's really exactly what it is. During the 80s, when WGN started to be broadcast across the nation, and Harry Carey was on the air, you know, just spouting about beautiful Wrigley Field, which was a tradition that began with Jack Brickhouse, but that Harry Carey continued it. You know, there sort of became this more, you know, a more legend, a mythology that grew up around Wrigley Field. It was the same times that people started going back onto the rooftops around Wrigley during the mid-80s. But it could have easily been gone. As recently as 1999, Fenway Park was considered a goner. And the truth is that we would not still have these places if they had not undergone recent renovations. Wrigley Field is currently going through a five-phase renovation right now, which began after the 2014 season. Fenway underwent its facelift about a decade ago, something like that. And the thing is that they've done just an incredible job, Fenway I'm talking about, in terms of marrying modernity and history. Because you walk in there and it still feels like this really magical place to see a game. In most parts of the park, it feels really intimate. The concourses are constricted because, you know, you can change out, you know, some things. You can update the luxury boxes and the concession areas, but you can't make it bigger because you're constrained by this urban physical space, same thing as Wrigley. And there's something very charming about that, of being constricted in a way that it was constricted 100 years ago. And that's really nice. It's just really nice to go into a place that has that kind of history. I say this for the record, as a Yankees fan, but in some ways, there's more Yankee history in Fenway, and I would rather go to a game there than I would at New Yankee Stadium.
My guest is freelance journalist Rafi Kohan, author of The Arena, Inside the Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Racing, Dubiously Funded, and Possibly Haunted Monuments of American Sports. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with freelance writer and editor Rafi Kohan, author of The Arena, Inside the Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Racing, Dubiously Funded, and Possibly Haunted Monuments of American Sports. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Rafi, the tailgate tradition is alive and well here in Texas and in many parts of the country, but you note that a lot of longtime fans can't afford to go to many games anymore, and season tickets now tend to be bought up by corporations as perks for star employees or for clients.
Yeah, I mean, and especially if we're talking about AT&T Stadium, where tickets after the new facility opened, there was also the surcharge of a PSL, a personal seat license. And for those who don't know what that is, it's basically a fee that you pay for the privilege of then buying season tickets. And in some cases, these could run as high as $150,000 per seat. That's an exorbitant amount of money to pay. I mean, yes, you might pay it out over 30 years, but the fact of the matter is that's not an easy expense. And I am in talking with a bunch of people down in Dallas, in Arlington, there were a lot of longtime fans that had to unfortunately give up their season tickets. And for those who haven't given up their season tickets, they oftentimes sell seats. They don't go to games because they try to make back some of that money. And that has created a more corporatized experience, and not just talking in terms of sponsorships, but in terms of just who's in the stands. There's less of a family vibe, a reunion vibe, where you see the same people week after week, where you know the people next to you, and when they don't show up, you wonder where they are and what's going on in their lives. Now it is. It's a much more schmoozing, or it's just strangers or tourists who come to see this iconic building, which is a beautiful building to go see, and tourists should go see it. But it has changed the experience in a way that you lose things like home field advantage, and it becomes less about the game.
Your section on ticket scalping was absolutely fascinating. I hadn't given it a lot of thought before, but the guys who do this outside the arena, they have to be organized, they have to be strategic to make any money. It's not so different than playing the stock market.
That's exactly what they say. And you're right, that's something I never paid much thought to either. I was always intrigued by these ticket scalpers. They always seemed like this kind of marginal men on the edges of stadiums. There was something edgy or illicit about what they were doing. And I enjoyed watching them work, or, you know, once or twice maybe buying a ticket from them. But I really relished the opportunity to walk up to these guys with a notepad and introduce myself as a reporter and say, "Can you tell me about what you do?" Unfortunately, the response at first was often, no. And they would walk away because, as you might imagine, ticket scalpers don't necessarily want to welcome a reporter into their world. But I did eventually meet a guy named Big Mike, a ticket scalper with a heart of gold, who called me my dude and allowed me to trail him everywhere he went. And it is, it's a complete stock market economy, just one that exists on the edges of stadiums. It's an entrepreneurial kind of street smart economy. Around Boston and Fenway Park, they call it grinding. You're buying and selling. And that's really what it is. You can make as much money off of a terrible game in April as you can for baseball as a playoff game in October, because it's all about working those margins. You know, if you can buy 5 tickets for $15 but sell each one of them for $10, then you've done great. It's the same thing as buying a ticket for $125 and then flipping it for $150. It's basically just buying and selling. And these guys say, you know, one key is don't fall in love with a ticket. That's what a guy named Jimmy near Fenway told me. Because some guys, they buy a ticket and they think, oh, it should be worth this much money. I'm not going to sell it until I get this much money. But that's how you end up holding on to it too long, because this is a stock. It's like a stock, but it's a stock with a shelf life. And if you hold it for too long, it implodes and the value is gone. As Jimmy put it to me as to why a ticket should be worth one thing and not another, he said, "An ice cream has no bones. So what? It's worth what it's worth."
If they have leftover stock, do they ever just walk in and watch the game?
Yeah, definitely. Big Mike brought me into what's called the club at Progressive Field where the Cleveland Indians play. And we hung out and we ate some food. And he told me all about some of his scalper road trips, which was another interesting element that, in fact, ticket scalpers, when it's out of season, whether it's not baseball season or football season, they'll travel around the country, oftentimes in packs, pursuing a concert like Taylor Swift around the country, or going to Vegas for a boxing match, or cruising the Southeast during college bowl season. So he told me, you know, lots of tales from his time on the road. And then we snuck out some food to feed his other scalper friends. He also gave me tickets to go to a Cleveland Cavaliers playoff game. So that is, it is something, it is a perk. That's one of the first perks I learned, which is when you're friends with ticket scalpers, you get to see some games.
Of course, some of these guys are doing this work because they have felony histories and no one else will hire them. This may not be their dream job, but it's work that they can do to support themselves.
100%. You know, as we said, this is an economy on the margins. And you don't need a background check. You don't, you know, need a resume. You don't need references to start selling tickets. You just show up, hopefully with a wad of cash and maybe a sign that says, "I need tickets." And whether it's because you can't get another job, or for some of these guys, it's just, you know, they fell in love with doing this 20, 30 years ago, during the heyday of scalping tickets, before things like StubHub took over and digital ticket markets made things more difficult. And now it's been two decades and you have no job history. And what other choice do you have but to keep working the streets?
It's impossible to do what amounts to a biography of the American Stadium without considering this strange role in modern history played by the New Orleans Superdome during Hurricane Katrina. Your lens for this was a guy named Raymond Smith, who took shelter there in 2005 and works there today selling concessions. And it just has to be so bizarre for him to return to this place that he associates with so much chaos.
Yeah, bizarre is one way to put it. I think it's so much. I mean, there's so much. He tries not to think about it. I mean, Raymond Smith is just someone I chanced into. And I knew when I was going to be spending time around the Superdome, you know, thinking about the history of domes in general and the history of the Superdome in particular, which has a lot of symbolic meaning for New Orleans well before Katrina ever flooded the city, that I wanted to sort of get people's Katrina stories, so to speak, because this was such a focal point during the storm and after the storm for the community and for the region, that I knew that there was something about it that still had to be processing. And as I was asking folks about their Katrina stories, I stumbled upon Raymond Smith. And he said, "I tell you what, meet me after the game and then let's talk." And in fact, I met him in the fourth quarter and we left the game before the game was over. We walked to the French Quarter and we talked and he told me his story. And it's really hard for him. In fact, he says he tries not to think about it because he's dealing with a lot of sort of post-traumatic stress from the experience of not only being there during Katrina, but sort of the fallout from the years that came after that, from being sent halfway, you know, sent to Houston while the rest of his family was scattered across the country, and just his entire life was upended. And now he's back in New Orleans and he can't get any other work, partly because the economy, you know, has shifted in such a way that a lot of the rebuilding effort went to outside workers. And also because he struggles with, you know, a mental disorder as a result of the storm. And he can't get any other job. This is the only thing he can do. He has no choice but every Sunday to go back to the scene of the crime, so to speak, and put a beer tray around his neck and walk up and down the aisles asking who wants a beer. These are the same seats where he slept during the storm, where he watched people fight and, you know, collapse and pray and scream and light fires during Katrina, when people didn't know what was going to be happening, when people didn't know when the government was coming to help. This is not a distant memory for him. It's something that's very real and very present every time he walks back into that building.
How did the idea of covering stadiums originate?
Well, you know, if I'm being honest, Chris, I think this whole thing was an elaborate excuse just to get to shoot a T-shirt cannon.
You mean the book?
Yeah. lifelong goal of mine. And I'll tell you, it did not disappoint. But to be a little bit more serious, I love going to games. I've always been a sports fan. And I have always noticed some of these other things, as we were saying about ticket scalpers. I noticed those guys, you know, the mascots. I noticed them, the grounds crew raking the dirt, or in Yankee Stadium they would do the YMCA during an inning break. I always noticed those things, and the stadium just felt like such a more like this very complex place, and it is. You know, on game days it turns into a small city unto itself. There's fire departments and police and medical, and there's traffic coordination, and there's hospital beds, and there's jail cells. There you have to feed tens of thousands of people and keep them safe. And I just wanted to know more. I was just curious about these other elements of the stadium experience that make game days so much more than just watching the game on the field. So I felt like this was a great opportunity to really spend a year traveling around the country and turning over some of those stones and just seeing what was underneath.
So that was actually great insight, and I should have phrased my question more clearly because I was curious about the origins of a domed stadium, which I know started in
Houston.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
No, it was well, cover is one of those words that means a couple of different things, and as a journalist, I'm not surprised that you took it the reporting way.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah, the T-shirt cannon probably did not make any sense. but domes, I mean, they started in Houston. It was in the, you know, the Astrodome was the very first dome. It opened in the mid-1960s, and it was the brainchild of a man named Roy Hoffines, known as the Judge. And it was for a team then known as the Colt 45s to play in, eventually the Houston Astros. And, this was not sort of the ideal place to play baseball, with muggy weather and insects. So play it inside. And really, the Astrodome was one of those things. I mean, it is one of those things that is just uniquely American. This idea was eccentric, considered so eccentric at the time. It was as outlandish as putting a man on the moon. Mm. And the second it came online that the Houston Astrodome opened, it basically reinvented the town. Suddenly, they went from being a cow town to a tech leader where anything was possible. If you can play baseball inside, anything is possible.
Part of what makes the walk into a football stadium or a baseball stadium so magical is laying eyes on that extraordinary field of green. It's not surprising that kind of perfection demands that you put a perfectionist in charge. I'm going to do station ID here, and then I want to talk about Ed Mangan, who is head groundskeeper at Turner Field. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, tell us, Rafi Kohan, about Ed Mangan.
Well, Ed is, as you said, the meticulous groundskeeper, head groundskeeper for the Atlanta Braves. And the reason that he, blipped onto my radar when I was thinking about where I should spend my time for a chapter about groundskeeping, I was reading about Ed, and he's been in charge of the Braves field for 25 years. And in addition to that, he's also in charge of the Super Bowl for the NFL. So he is sort of a multi-sport master of the craft, you know, someone who has military precision in terms of what he expects out of his guys and what he expects out of his field. As he puts it, he's got a plan, and then he's got a backup for that plan, and then he's got a backup for the backup of that plan. Because when you're dealing with nature, as groundskeepers do, there's not enough preparation that can be done. Things go wrong. Things will go wrong. You have to expect them to go wrong, whether it's a storm populating out of the tropics or the hoses burn, you know, the under the field hoses, water system bursting, and then suddenly having a flood in the middle of the infield, which, you know, is something that happens. And as Ed puts it, you know, you cannot have fun when you're doing this. This is not about having fun. This is about being precise. It's about knowing your next move. And it's a very demanding job. You know, 15 hours a day during the season, you have to show up before the sun rises, especially if the tarp's on the field, so it doesn't cook beneath, you know, the infield doesn't cook beneath the tarp. Mm. And then you're there until well after the game is done so that you can tend to the field and prepare it for the next day. It's really an amazing sort of, you know, almost like bonsai tree clipping type craft, because these guys put in the effort day after day. Same thing every day, precision, mowing the grass, alternating their patterns to make sure the grass always stands up straight. And, you know, it was pretty amazing to see firsthand.
We use the term level playing field so often that it's easy to forget that, of course, it originates from sports. What did you learn about how groundskeepers of the past might have tried to confer a subtle advantage to the home team?
Or not so subtle. You know, what's interesting to me is even the idea of home field advantage, something that came about as a result of the field of play. In the early days of baseball, baseball crowds were not partisan. They were just there to see the competition. But the reason that home teams had an advantage was because these fields were not necessarily well tended to. There might be weird slopes or ruts or just a tree in the middle of the outfield. And basically, you had an advantage because you knew how to navigate those obstacles. As time went on and the craft became a little bit more professionalized, not too much professionalized. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, 100 years, that, you know, at Sportsman Park in St. Louis, the grounds crew basically consisted of a goat who they would bring out into the outfield to help trim the grass. But guys like the Murphy brothers, who were early groundskeepers, and the Bossards, a sort of legendary dynastic family of groundskeeping, they found ways to really confer an advantage to the teams, whether it was sprinkling soap on the pitching mound so that when the other team's pitcher would reach down to grab a handful of dirt to get a good grip, the ball would get very slippery. Or hardening the base paths or the dirt right around home plate so that the team could hit a chopper straight down and it would bound up very high. Hmm. This is what we now know as the Baltimore chop. And that started with the Baltimore Orioles, with the Murphy brothers.
My guest is journalist Rafi Kohan. His new book is called The Arena: Inside the Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Racing, Dubiously Funded, and Possibly Haunted Monuments of American Sports. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd speaking with journalist Rafi Kohan about his book, The Arena: Inside the Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Racing, Dubiously Funded, and Possibly Haunted Monuments of American Sports. Join us on Twitter at KERAThink or email think@kera.org. Rafi, stadiums cannot use just any ordinary sod. So what is special about the turf grown for sports that allows it to hold up even through one game of the kind of punishment that it takes?
Well, this, by the way, might have been my absolute favorite experience during the whole year of reporting, was going down and taking a road trip to these sod farms, to one sod farm in particular in what's known as the Redneck Riviera, the southern coast of Alabama. Sod farm by the name of Bent Oak, run by a guy named Mark Pollock. And, well, they actually have a very particular type of sod that they grow. It's grass grown on plastic. And you know, you may not know what that means. I certainly wouldn't have known what that meant. But basically what they do is they grow the grass in the ground for about a year, you know, typical grass as grass grows. And then they harvest it. And they transport it and put it down literally on top of like almost like a black garbage plastic bag or a black tarp. Mm-hmm. And what happens then is the roots, instead of going back into the earth, is they hit the plastic and they turn back up and it grows within itself. And it becomes very dense with roots. It becomes very heavy. And what they do is they rake in sand for another year. It's about a 2-year process all told. And they fatten it up until it's about 2 inches thick. And it's basically no dirt in this sod. It's just roots and sand. And when it's ready to be transported, they cut it up into strips and they roll it up and they transport it on, you know, to the stadium, to wherever it's going to be played. And it's so heavy, each one of these strips, that basically you lay it down and it is ready to play tomorrow. There's nothing that a 300-pound lineman can do to it that it can't withstand. Watching, you know, you pull up a corner of this sod and the whole thing comes up with it. It's so strong. It's unbelievable.
It is impossible to read this book and not vow to pay closer attention to team mascots from now on. These guys work as hard as the athletes, and they may be nearly as susceptible to on-the-job injuries.
I got to spend some time with Dan Mears, who is the Casey Wolf, a Hall of Fame mascot for the Kansas City Chiefs. And well, he actually suffered a really bad injury a few years ago. He was doing a stunt. He was practicing a stunt, I should say, where he was basically like bungee jumping out of the lights that was then and then zip lining down into the field. But they misjudged the distance of the initial jump, and he landed on the stadium seats basically and ended up in the hospital for a week or two or something. It was a pretty serious injury. That's obviously more of the exception than the typical type of rule. But these guys will say, you know, they're familiar with ibuprofen. They're definitely used to getting an IV bag occasionally after a game of, you know, dancing inside of a really hot and we should mention really stinky costume. And that's, you know, but that's just the nature of the job. You might say, well, these guys, who would want to do that? And in fact, Dan would be the first to admit, as he put it, mascots are two peas short of a casserole. They're, you know, to want to do this sort of thing, you got to be a little, you know, a little different, a little off. But they have a great time. And, you know, as he put it to me, that, you know, if he's walking by a goalpost and he sees a kid looking at him, he'll pretend like he doesn't see the goalpost and run right into it. And if he sees that kid laughing, he'll do it again. Doesn't matter if it hurt. He'll do it again. That's just the nature of being a mascot. That's what you care about.
How much do they have to pay attention to what's happening on the field so that their performance is sort of adjusted accordingly?
Definitely they do. And I think especially more so if you think about it in terms of the marathon season that is baseball.
Yeah.
Because, you know, over the course of the year, basically baseball, I love baseball, but basically baseball's boring. And, you know, the mascot can't get in the way of the game. It has all the time in the world to gallivant about and try and engage fans. But as soon as you get to really important games, whether it's in September in the playoff hunt or in October during the actual playoffs, the mascots will tell you that we don't want to get in the way of the game. We want to engage and we want to help pump up the crowd. But in those important moments, they want to do it in a way that is really organic to the action on the field.
Okay, I have to know about this guy, the amazing Sladek that you hung out with.
Sladek.
Sladek, okay. He has a really strange, that's not even his name, we should note. He has another name.
Yes, his real name is Gary Borstelman.
Okay.
And Sladek is, if memory serves, his maternal grandmother's maiden name. But as he put it to me, you know, the amazing Borstelman just didn't have the same ring to it.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah. And Sladek, who's become a real friend of mine, I had no plans to profile a halftime performer, an NBA halftime performer as part of this book. But I was at a Cleveland Cavaliers playoff game. In fact, it was on the ticket of Big Mike, the ticket scalper, who allowed me into the game. And I got to witness the halftime show, which was performed by the amazing Sladek. And I was just blown away. So I should say what his performance is, which is it's called the Tower of Chairs. And he puts a folding table at center court, and then he stacks six wooden chairs, one on top of another, until they're about 20 feet in the air. He climbs the spindles all the way to the top and then does handstands on top of them. And I was just blown away. I did not get up to go to the bathroom. I didn't go get something to eat. I was just transfixed. So I reached out to him and wanted to learn more about his story. And he has, I don't want to give too much away, but his story is just fascinating. He spent more than 30 years as a circus performer, traveling around the country, doing different stunts, having a few close brushes with death. And this was something I never really thought about. Like, who are these people that perform for us? And what kind of risks do they take? And what is their backstory? And his is a really unique one. He's had some ups and downs in his life. And right now, he's really going strong. He's, in my opinion, he's one of the top arena halftime performers in the country right now. He's performing at NBA All-Star Games, and he's a darling of the TNT crew. The guys like Charles Barkley and Shaquille O'Neal, they always give him airtime. Maybe just because he's almost 60, and he wears this crazy old outfit. It's a rhinestone spangled jumpsuit with a big blousy shirt underneath. It looks like a pirate shirt from, you know, that Seinfeld episode, right, where the pirate shirt, it kind of looks like that. And he is just a madman. Who would want to do this? Who would want to go, in front of 20,000 people and put their life on the line night after night after night? So he actually asked me to be his assistant for one game, and I did it. And it was the scariest thing I've ever done in my life. And I was on the floor the whole time. So I can't even imagine what it's like, that view from the top up there.
So your job was to take, like, one of these chairs on a long pole and feed it up to him. That does sound terrifying, because if a mistake happens, like, it could be your fault if something happens.
Oh, yeah. I thought there was a genuine possibility that I was going to kill this guy. the chairs are a lot heavier than they looked. And the pole, once you lift it up, it becomes very top heavy. And I was very concerned that I was going to plunge this whole thing just directly into his tower of chairs. In fact, toward the end of the act, he was like hissing at me, like, get it closer, get it closer. But I was so nervous that I was going to knock him over that it took me a little while to get it close enough that he could reach it.
Everybody knows that stadiums also house concerts and other special events, and sometimes they're the home venue for more than one sports team. What's easy to forget is how many changeable elements have to be put up or taken down every time an arena has a different event. This was really interesting to me.
Yeah, the behind-the-scenes logistics of these places are just, it's like this shadow world that exists, the phantoms of the arena. I got to spend an overnight at a Prudential Center in Newark, New Jersey, which is where the New Jersey Devils play and where Seton Hall Pirates basketball team plays, and they host a whole bunch of other events. And I literally spent the night. We had like a sleepover without any sleeping, where I helped lay down the floor on top of the ice after a Devils game in preparation for a concert. And I got to see the sort of slow transformation that takes place, which is, as I put it, it's not sort of like the fast transformation of the butterfly emerging, from the cocoon, but it's sort of like the internal, slow internal work, because it's not sexy. It doesn't happen quick. It's just, piece by piece, the arena begins to transform. And it was really cool to see, because, we know that it happens, but to actually appreciate the sort of small efforts and the men and women who come in after we leave to clean up after us and to adjust the floor, to sweep up our beer, literally from, to clean the beer off the ice sheet after a concert, potentially, was really amazing to see that side of it, because without them, we wouldn't be able to enjoy half of the events that we do.
How have sports venues adjusted to Americans' changing tastes, to the extent that you can't just sell peanuts and Cracker Jacks anymore?
Right. And that's, the Citi Field in New York, where the Mets play, is widely credited as sort of popularizing this movement of having celebrity chefs. And, they have Shake Shack in the outfield. And I believe David Chang now has a restaurant there, or at least some sort of outpost. And I think that's part of sort of the initial, the initial trends that we started talking about this hour, which are about these kind of segmented experiences and having something that's an add-on, something of extra value that entices you to come to the game. Especially for football. I mean, baseball is more of a transient crowd and people are more apt to get up and walk around and try some of these things. But for football in particular, it's hard to get people to come to games. The Traffic is terrible. The tickets are expensive. The game is really made for TV. The in-seat experience is, occasionally can leave something to be desired. So we need these kind of extra value points, these extra experiential elements that get us to come to the stadium. But I should say the flip side of these, Shake Shack and David Chang and, high-end celebrity chefs coming to stadiums are these kind of Frankenstein concoctions of, deep-fried Oreos on a stick or the Burgeritza, which is something in Atlanta. They had in Atlanta, which was like a giant hamburger, which instead of buns had 2 8-inch pepperoni pizzas. In Arlington at the Texas Rangers ballpark, they have something called the Boomstick, which is like a 2-foot hot dog covered in chili and cheese and onions. And according to Delaware North, which is a concessions company that works with the Rangers, that was one of the original sort of Frankenstein concoctions. So you guys can take a measure of pride of having launched a thousand heart attacks.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What happens, Rafi, to a stadium when its team moves on? Do those buildings, does anybody care about them anymore?
Oh, absolutely. These are really important buildings, from places like Wrigley and Fenway where, memory really sort of wraps itself into this physical structure that when the team does move on, especially if it's not demolished, which sort of creates a little bit of closure, we can kind of have emotional closure, they kind of haunt us in a way because they meant something to our community. They meant something to us personally, whether we ever went to a game or not. They were points of civic pride. A couple of the stadiums I looked at on this front are the Houston Astrodome and the Pontiac Silverdome. Two similar but also very different examples. Because for the Astrodome, as we talked about earlier, it was this really important building. Put Houston on the map, meant so much to the community. And in Houston, which as Ed Emmett, who is the county judge, I believe, down there in Harris County, put it that Houston is very quick to just tear things down and move on. It's, high metabolism rate. But for some reason, the Astrodome was something that people did not want to demolish and then regret having seen it, having destroyed it. In fact, they have major preservation efforts going on there now. And as far as the current plan is, it's going to be preserved as a kind of indoor park, which is cool because people will get to still be part of the building and appreciate the building. The building's paid off as well as low annual costs as far as stadiums go.
All right, that's our time, so I'm going to have to say goodbye. Rafi Kohan is a freelance writer, former deputy editor of the New York Observer. His new book is called The Arena. Rafi, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.